Good evening. Good to see everybody this evening. For those visiting with us, the format of the study is we'll go around the room. The questions are open to brothers of the church. I will ask a brother the question and then open the floor to other brothers. And we'll just work our way around the room that way. I did have a PowerPoint. And I had some pretty neat stuff on it. But I don't know where I saved it. It wasn't on my memory stick. I had a nice map of Garden of Gethsemane. I had a chart about the high priest and a cool picture of Peter chopping off Malchus' ear and standing around the fire, too. But you won't get to see it. Thank Landon for reading this evening. The first question has to do with verses 1 to 3. Cole, this is for you if you'd like it. It's a three-part question. What garden did Jesus go to? Why did Judas lead the troops to this garden? And why did the troops and officers take weaponry to arrest Jesus?
This same account is depicted in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And according to those depictions, it was in the Garden of Gethsemane. That's found in Matthew chapter 26, verses 36 through 46, Mark chapter 14, verses 32 through 42, and Luke chapter 22, verses 39 through 46. And like I said, they say there that he went to the Garden of Gethsemane, which is a garden at the foot of the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem. And why did Judas lead his troops there? Well, he expected Jesus to be there because, as we read in verse 2, it was a place that Jesus and his disciples frequented. So, he was expecting them to be there. So for the third part, why did the troops and officers take weaponry to arrest Jesus? They expected resistance, and rightfully so, like seeing what Peter did. And Jesus had also escaped arrest before, so... No, they really want to catch me.
Very good. Who else would like to address these questions? The garden? Why did Jesus go there? Why did the officers take weapons? Awesome.
A couple things. Really, only things to add to what Cole said. He covered the question very well. What I didn't realize was how large a detachment of troops was. I've got one number here that says it was a tenth part of the legion, which consisted of 4,200 troops. So that would be, somewhere around 420 troops, I believe. I had another number around here somewhere. But it's in the hundreds of troops that would be plodding through this garden. And I guess in my mind, I don't know. I was thinking maybe a smaller number, somewhere around 100, but this is a huge company that is going out here. As to the why, I think Cole's right as far as he had escaped from them before, he had slipped past them before. And also, I think it's interesting, we don't read about any of the other occurrences with the Garden of Gethsemane. It says here it's a place that they visited often. But I think that tells you a little bit what kind of a place this was. It was a very quiet place. This was, wasn't teaching, doesn't seem to be a whole lot of teaching going on here. This is a private place. And it says something about Judas, either good or bad, I can't tell, that he chose to do it in a private place, away from everyone, to capture Jesus. I don't know if that's good or bad. But I do think it's interesting that he chose that place instead of in public or somewhere else.
Mark?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it was planned on the part of the Jewish officials and Judas. Probably Judas didn't have a whole lot to do with those administrative decisions about when it's going to happen. But the reason there were so many troops present, it's Passover. And the troops were ordinarily stationed at Caesarea Philippi on the coast. That's where the governor's residence was. The governor didn't live in Jerusalem. He came to Jerusalem to visit. And so this is the Passover. It's the time when the Jews are their most unruly. The city's swelled to 1 million people, and there's the highest likelihood of problems, riots, fighting. And so the troops have been mostly moved out of Caesarea Philippi down to Jerusalem. So these are all troops that aren't used to being there, and they're there to quell insurrection. And so that's the way I'm sure the Jews phrase this. We have an insurrectionist that we need to capture and arrest, and that's why they took so many individuals. He may have people there with him that will fight back. And so the soldiers are ready to throw down with anybody that's going to resist them.
Anybody else to address this question?
Just a couple other tidbits that might be added to. I'm sure your picture adequately showed the Mount of Olives to the east of Jerusalem, across the Kidron Brook. Something that I learned in my reading that I didn't appreciate before, this Mount of Olives, there was clusters of olive trees on this mount. And it sounded to me like, by my reading, that there were different gardens. And this particular garden, the Garden of Gethsemane, and Gethsemane, we've heard this before, means oil press. So the likelihood of an oil press being in this particular garden, and I hadn't appreciated this before until going through this question, but I like to think that Jesus wanted to go someplace where Judas knew they could find him.
Perhaps Judas also knew this place was a easier place to capture.
Verse 2, that the disciples entered into the garden, suggesting that there was at least a gate and there might have been walls. So that might have been another way to kind of envision this place.
Something also interesting is that there's really two groups of soldiers. There's the temple guard and then the Roman soldiers in this. And another, I guess the actual site of the Garden of Gethsemane is not known. There's like four different places that different groups think the Garden of Gethsemane is at. So they're all off of the Mount of Olives, but there's just different little places to think the Garden is at. Anybody else on this question? Okay, let's move on to question number 2. This covers verses 4-9. Why did the soldiers fall back when Jesus confirmed his identity? Why did Jesus ask them to let the disciples go? How does this account compare with the other accounts of the capture of Jesus? And would these differences count as discrepancies or errors? Austin.
So, the soldiers fall back when Jesus asks, "Whom do you seek?" They say, "Jesus of Nazareth." He says, "I am he." And verse 6, they drew back and fell to the ground. I do believe that this is some kind of a miraculous happening. There are some that suggest that this is not, they kind of tripped, frankly, because he was so bold in his speaking. That's what happened. So I tend to think that this was more an expressing of Jesus' power, however slight, frankly. That would have been, it was enough to make them fall back. And there was one commentator that suggested that was perhaps the reason why they were so lenient and congenial in letting the disciples go. Because they are, as Bart said, they are there to quell a rebellion. He is an insurrectionist. They've dealt with insurrectionists before. The only way to completely snuff it out is to get all the leaders, the main guys, round them up and kill them. Well, they only get Jesus. And I think, to the second question, it speaks very highly of Jesus. Obviously it does, that he asked for his disciples to be let go. Destinies, if you will, their goals and their roles were much different than what his were going to be. And it was essential that they be let go and not be executed just like he was. So I think that's very important. It's very important as to how the rest of history really shakes out. And of course, there are some differences. There are some differences between each of the accounts. Some are longer, some are shorter. This particular one has the mention of the soldiers falling back. And I think John's unique in that amongst the other Gospels. Matthew goes into more detail of things that Jesus said to Peter when he cut off Malchus's ear. Can I not call 10,000 or 12 legions of angels? I almost said 10,000, it's not. 12 legions of angels. And I think it's important for us to remember that although one or a skeptic might call these discrepancies, they might call them errors or something like that, why don't all the accounts match up? I think it's actually a better proof of the legitimacy of the Bible and the legitimacy of witnesses. All witnesses are going to tell the story differently. They're going to get main points, main events, but they may come at it from a different point or in the chronology that they approach it. No different than if you and I saw the same movie, we would have differences of opinions about it because of where we are in our life or anything else. I think the same thing applies to the witnesses of the trial, the arrest of Jesus. And I think it adds credence. If they were all identical, then it could be very easily said, well, one guy came in here and he wrote all of these, and there's no imagination. There's part of the texture of the scriptures, and the fact that it's a little bit rough tells you that it's genuine. I think that's powerful.
You get a more complete story. More different viewpoints. Who else would like to address this set of questions? Dennis?
On the first part of that, I think it's really interesting. You have this huge crowd coming up, coming forward, obviously very hostile. And it says, Jesus went forward. Well, he goes forward. He's the initiator of this contact now. And I think that it shows his, of course, his divine power and his complete authority and his complete control over the whole situation. And I think that, I agree with Austin, I think it was his divine power put him back. What is mystery to me is why they continued after that. But anyway, I think if Jesus was, you know, demonstrating he's in control of the situation.
Right. Yes. Mark.
Why would they continue? I think if you imagine the situation, it's just, you know, thinking about it and may not be correct, but you've got a large number of people in this garden, 600 maybe, a cohort, 400 to 600, but 200 to 600, somewhere around that. So you've got a large group of soldiers, and they're not going to all squeeze in the same small space. There's going to be a considerable number who aren't going to be able to hear Jesus to begin with. Any contingent of soldiers is not going to approach in single file. And these are trained Roman soldiers. They're the best in the world. And so they are going to approach the situation looking for an assault. They're going to be on guard. And so there's going to be a lot of these soldiers who are spread out over the side of this mountain. And so when I think it says some of them fell back, I think it's some of them. I think the people up front are affected by this miraculous event. Probably the Jews, the Pharisees, are part of those people. They're the ones egging this on, of course. And so some of the soldiers fall back, and then the reason why it continues is because the Jews, after 3.5 years of Jesus working miracles and doing these things, they know that's going to happen. They're so dead set against Jesus, it doesn't matter what he does. So they would reassure the Roman captain, legionnaire, whoever it is, we need to get this done. And so that, in my mind's eye, it's just not physically possible for all 600 who spread out all over this to fall down and then for them to continue. I think it was a localized event. The ones in the front fell back, and then they're encouraged by the powerful officials that they're basically following their orders to continue with.
Anybody else on this?
Yeah, I agree with what's been said. I found a quote from a writer last named Trapp, His quote was, "Here our Savior let out a little beam of the majesty of his deity, and 500 men fell before him." You know, Jesus said, "I am." In my New King James Version Bible, the "he" is in italics, so that was added by the translators. So John records Jesus saying, "I am," as God 9 different times in his gospel account. So this is a phrase that Jesus has used many times. This time it had power. And I think there's something supernatural there. And when you get into the differences, I almost said discrepancy, the differences between the gospel accounts, you know, there's quite a few different things we could point at. Chapter 15, 16, 17, that whole prayer that I think was in the upper room before they, verse 1 of chapter 18, when Jesus has spoken these words, he went out with his disciples over the brook Kidron. So I'm still putting Jesus in that upper room, and he's given this 3-chapter speech, multiple prayers that's not recorded by the others. So to have different pieces not recorded, that's not a big deal to me.
Out there, I am he, or that's good. But if you look at how that is phrased in there, like Jesus says, "Whom are you seeking?" And they answered him, "Jesus of Nazareth." So it's kind of, the Nazareth is a derogatory term related to the Jews because that's a lowly place. And then he says, "I am," showing that he is divine. So there's his response. Anybody else? We're going to move on to the next question. Question number 3. Why might John reveal Peter as being the attacker when the other Gospels did not? And why was Peter rebuked by Jesus and told to put away his sword? Bill?
Well, I thought this was a very interesting question, and it made me dig around a little bit. You know, from a worldly perspective, Peter, Andrew, James, and John, considered the inner circle. And from a worldly perspective, you might think, well, John was the only one that he felt that felt like he was on a level to be critical of Peter and call him out. So that's one way of looking at it. You know, and for me, it's just as easy to suspect, and maybe more so, that the other gospel writers, weren't told by divine revelation to include it as John was. I prefer to think that way. Notice that John didn't reveal Jesus healing the cut off ear, although the other gospel writers did. So that's the first part of the question. Why was Peter rebuked by Jesus and told to put away his sword? Well, Matthew records Jesus telling Peter in Matthew chapter 26, verse 52, that those who take up the sword will perish by the sword. So in our text here in John chapter 18, verse 11, Jesus rebukes Peter, orders him to put his sword in its sheath, and says, "Shall I not drink the cup which my Father has given me?" And in my way of thinking, Peter, stop. I don't want you messing this up. The Lord's got a plan, and let me carry it out. So I kind of found myself thinking that way. Now, I've done this before, and I've suggested this before, but it was Malchus's left ear. So that made me think that Peter was left-handed. Because a right-handed guy is not going to cut off a left-handed guy's ear without really getting crazy gyre. But a left-handed guy cutting off a right-handed guy's ear, it's just one of these things. You just lean over, and there goes. Now, in my reading, I learned another possibility, that Peter was actually standing behind Malchus. And here's a guy that's not a soldier. He's close. I'm gonna fight for the Lord. And from behind, possibly, Peter cuts off his right hand. Peter's right-handed cuts off Malchus's right ear. So all of that's just something to speculate about. John naming Malchus might help prove this statement John naming Malchus might help prove his statement in chapter 18, verse 16, that John was known to the priest because John knew this guy Malchus. There's a possibility of that. You remember the girl that lets them in? She was known. She was known to John. And it's also suggested that Malchus might have actually become a Christian, and that would be one by calling his name out in this occasion, and him later becoming a Christian. Wouldn't that be powerful? Wouldn't that be a powerful testimony to the rest of the brotherhood? We don't know these things, but it's interesting to speculate.
Yeah, it's an interesting speculation, especially after the ear was healed. He would have known that. We also would like to address this question of why might John reveal Peter as the attacker, and why was Peter rebuked? Bart.
I think Bill said it was awesome. One of the possibilities, a lot of people think John's gospel was leaked. In other words, it was the last gospel written. John got old, and then he wrote the book of Revelation, and he also said, I need to write a gospel too, because the other synoptics are very similar to each other in a way that John's gospel isn't. So John gives us the last gospel, and it's significantly different. And Peter's dead. Peter was killed by Nero in the 60s, and so maybe the reason his name isn't revealed in the synoptics is because the Jews obviously could read the Gospels and say, well, let's get that guy. And so Peter would have even more people chasing after him than he already did. So that's one possibility.
And Malchus is probably dead by that time as well. So, anybody else? Another on the last part of this question, why was Peter rebuked? We see a very similar thing in Matthew 16, 21 to 23. Peter had a very similar attitude here. So Matthew 16, 21 to 23. From that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised on the third day. Then Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, far be it from you, Lord. This shall not happen to you. But he turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You are an offense to me, for you are not mindful of the things of God, but of the things of men. It's a very similar rebuke to what Jesus gave Peter here of shall I not drink the cup which my Father has given? Anybody else before we move to the next question? Question number four. Why was Jesus taken first to Annas before Caiaphas? Second part is, why was Caiaphas described as the high priest that year? And who was the other disciple that followed Jesus? Right? Would you like this?
Yeah. And also in regards to the last question, I think Peter's revealed as the one, also thematically, because it fits with Peter's kind of disposition throughout the Gospels. But in regards to this question here, why was Jesus taken to Annas first before Caiaphas? I read two different things. Annas either being just geographically closer, just the first stop on the way, or also that Annas, I suppose, Bart could give you a better run through than me, but Annas had kind of been disposed from his authority, and some of the Jews still kind of regarded him as the high priest. So his counsel and expertise was sort of sought after before they went down the legal proceedings, per se. So that's a possibility as to why they went to Annas first. Why was Caiaphas, described as the high priest that year? I think it's just kind of written a little odd. That year is in regards to that time and place of Jesus' crucifixion, the year in which he was crucified, not necessarily to indicate some sort of transitional terms of the high priest or anything like that. And then who was the other disciples that followed Jesus? Most likely that was John and the author here, and that being why he, I suppose it's not really that relevant, but it shows that John wasn't questioned in the same regard that Peter was. So John's just able to go through, and then Peter has to go through this sort of grilling, per se.
Great. Right. Anybody else on this question? Regarding Annas and Caiaphas, who the other disciple is.
Yeah, you mentioned your chart. So this kind of stuff I love. You know, wish we had your chart to look at. Annas was old, obviously, and he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas. So think about that family relationship for a second. Father-in-law. Anyone make your father-in-law upset? And he had been, as Hunter pointed out, he had been removed by the Romans in AD 15. And then there were a couple other guys that took high priest for a couple years. And then Caiaphas was, the Romans were doing all this. The Romans were tinkering with the high priesthood. Imagine how the Jews felt about that. When you're a high priest for life until God removes you. But here come the Romans, and the Romans are like, nope, you, not you, you know. And so that kind of stuff's going on, and so they're just unhappy. And Annas, in their eyes, is still high priest, even though he's not legally the high priest. So they have to do this dance where they respect Annas, and the Lord goes to him first in his private residence, in his courtyard, and then later to Caiaphas. So that's what's going on. It's this strange, it's a familial thing, but it's also the Romans are messing with them. And, I find it very interesting. And then the whole thing about John being known by Caiaphas is odd. I don't know if you have any comment on that, but it's like we thought about it when we studied it. How is John, a fisherman from Galilee, known to Caiaphas? The Bible doesn't tell us. But we sort of imagine that maybe John and Zebedee and James had the best fish, and they brought the best fish, and they actually knew the high priest. The high priest was like, whose fish are these? And then they got introduced somehow. And so that's how he was. But we obviously, unless somebody else, maybe somebody knows how John was known.
Seems like a long way to pack fish down to Jerusalem. Maybe that's good. Well,
these were crooked leadership. So if they got good fish, they might be able to lower some tax advantages and different things like that. So we don't know. I don't know if I had found this before, but according to Kaufman, Annas had put a Sabbath breaker to death. And that was a violation of the laws the Romans had. And so they took him out of control, figuratively, sort of. He was still in control, obviously. So. Yeah, I think that was an interesting tidbit for me to learn.
I think both you guys got most of the stuff that was on my chart, but Caiaphas was had the high priest appointment for 18 years, so he obviously had to be pretty friendly with the Romans to maintain that. So that may have been another reason why the Jews respected Annas more than Caiaphas, is because of his relationship, Caiaphas' relationship with the Romans. Anybody else on this question? Let's move on to question number 5. Why might Peter have felt pressure to lie and deny knowing Jesus? What effect did these events have on Peter? Dennis.
I think fear for his own well-being, that first comes to mind, obvious self-preservation. If he was outed as a follower of Jesus, who's at the center of this whole deal going on here, this whole incident, he too might be drug in and charged along with Jesus. But just as a side note, I don't understand why is John coming and going and not being paid too. So I don't understand that. Anyway, part of that. Secondly, what effect did these events have on Peter? Well, although he was weak in faith, obviously, at this particular time, I think the incident was pretty much a turning point for Peter. His faith grew rapidly after this, and Jesus' first words to Peter, very first words, were follow me in Mark 1, verse 7, and his last words, recorded words, were you follow me in John 21, 22. Everything in between those challenges Peter did to follow the Lord. So we all know he often stumbled along the way, and he would become a recognized leader among the disciples, one of the inner circle, and also preached first sermon on Pentecost, First and Second Peter.
Thank you. Who else would like to address why Peter might have felt pressure to lie and what effect these events have? Awesome.
You know, reading through these verses, I guess it just struck me a little bit different as far as the pressure that he felt. And Dennis was talking about that, and I thought, you know, I don't really have anything really to add to that. But in the name of self-preservation, Peter was obviously, he was very bold in everything nearly that he did. Willing to, of course, he was right there in the garden, and he was the one who had the sword drawn. He was the one who attacked first, if you want to call it that. So it wasn't a matter of boldness, and then, of course, he's rebuked by the Lord, so that's a hit on him right there, and on his confidence. And then he's in the midst of all these people that he was directly close to. And of course, it's dark. All they have is lanterns out there. And I think perhaps that may be a reason why John is able to move freely back and forth, because they probably didn't recognize John. He may have been often in a shadow compared to where the rest of the group was. You know, who knows? But Peter was the one who caused the most ruckus and the one whose face they would have identified first or better. So the pressure is on, and obviously, I try to put myself in that situation. When you know that these are men who have no problem killing, and pretty much killing on the spot, and also killing in very horrible fashion, it would be incentive to say, no, that wasn't me. You got it all wrong. And as Jesus had told Peter before these events happened, Satan longs to sift you like wheat. This is that moment. Thank you.
Mark. I think a good way to look at it is King David situation. David sinned with Bathsheba, and that sin led him into murder. Peter is a transgressor in the garden. Jesus had told them not to use violence. Jesus committed, Isaiah 53, verse 9, did no violence. What Peter does in the garden is sinful. He's a transgressor in the garden, cutting off Malchus's ear. And that leads him into more sin. So Kaufman makes that point. I have a quote, I can read Kaufman's point, that it's a spiral. When you commit one sin, you're more likely to get another. And the reason I think, you know, this opens a door for us and shows us that, and Kaufman says this, John was able to, as a disciple, to come and go. The decision had been made to focus on Jesus at that point. But Peter knows that he's the one that cut off Malchus's ear. And in his heart, he thinks, if they know that, if I identify myself as a disciple, then I'll be arrested. Or maybe, well, as we know, one of Malchus's relatives is there. And so maybe Peter saw that guy. And he's frightened because of that. So his sin in the garden leads him to even greater sin to deny Jesus.
Well, I agree with you in that I think Peter is thinking more logically at this point rather than when he's got that high emotion and the men fall back and he thinks it's go time. Now he realizes in verse 18 it says the servants and officers are there. So there are there's soldiers around that fire, and then also, as you say, back I think in verse 26 that the relative amount. So he knows that he can be identified as the aggressor at that point.
I guess I wonder, why is he at the high priest's house if he's so scared? You know what I mean? Like, if he was so fearful for his life when he denied, I think maybe he was trying to watch after Jesus. And he has a habit of, you know, acting before he thinks. And I think this might be another, and maybe that's why John included that, you know, identified him as the person who cut off Malchus's ear to lend credence to that. Maybe he's acting before he thinks. Maybe he ran over there and he's like, I'm going to watch after him. I've got him. And then I imagine there's a conversation that happens, and this woman approaches him finally and says, hey, are you that guy? You know, he's like, no, that's not me. You know, and I think his intent was good, but obviously I think he was thinking with his fleshly mind and not his spiritual mind at that point.
Right, and that goes to really the rebuke of Jesus. Sean, not there. Okay. Anybody else?
notice where Peter was? Peter was in amongst the enemy. I mean, he was in amongst the people. So, and I think very likely many of them, like verse 26, there were probably many there that were also at the garden. But here, Peter's got himself in this situation. I want to point out, what effect did these events have on Peter? Mark 14, verse 72, records Peter weeping over his denial of Jesus. Luke 22, verse 62, so Peter went out and wept bitterly. And verse 61, and Jesus turning and looking at Peter. Oh, my. It just breaks your heart. Matthew chapter 27 and verse 75 records Peter, remembering the words of Jesus, went out and wept bitterly. And John said nothing about this. John didn't say anything about it. Again, this makes you kind of wonder. John doesn't acknowledge Peter doing anything about when the rooster crowed. So, you know, I believe these events helped Peter to be a humble man, and he learned to trust the Lord more and more.
Well, another event that John does record in chapter 20, verse 4, is when they think that the body of Jesus is taken, Peter's running to see what's happened. So, kind of to Lance's point, he was always looking out for Jesus, but not necessarily in the right place. Let's move on to question number 6. We've got 4 minutes left. Why would the high priest ask Jesus further about his doctrine and disciples? What response did this prompt from Jesus? Was his answer disrespectful to the high priest? Lance, would you like to answer this?
Sure. Well, I think why the high priest was asking him questions, I think it's part of interrogation. I mean, the first step to an interrogation is going to be interviewing people, and then it's going to be questioning. And I think they're at that stage right now. And I mean, what better way to make someone look guilty than words from their own mouth? And Jesus was 100, light years ahead of these people, And so I think he was fishing for proof to back up their charge of blasphemy to come from Jesus' own mouth. Because I think that would be a pretty open closed case for them. Jesus' response to them was basically like, the people that are accusing, why don't you go ask them? I think he was speaking to his own character, because he's like, I didn't do this in secret. I'm not secretly, hiding messages and having meetings with people. I've been openly saying all of these things. So why don't you go ask them? And obviously, he knew all along what their leading questions were trying to get him to say. Was his answer disrespectful to the high priest? It wasn't disrespectful, but I think sometimes, if you've ever heard, when someone's wrong, their initial reaction is getting angry. I think he revealed their ignorance in that moment, and I think they were embarrassed. And obviously, their intent wasn't to get justice, because they, open hand hit him. While he's bound, and you don't do that, that's not justice. And so, and Jesus knew all of these things the entire time, but I think they revealed his ignorance, and that maybe, was translated as disrespect to them.
Anybody else on this question? On why would the high priest be asking Jesus about his doctrine? The response? And was Jesus disrespectful?
Again, I think it's interesting, and a little nugget I hadn't picked up before, but I did this time, is that he's asking about his disciples. And again, in the garden, he asked for his disciples to be let go, to let these go away. And now the high priest is asking about his disciples. And I find that very interesting. Of course, in Jesus' response, he doesn't say anything about his disciples. Again, protecting them for what they would be able to do one day. And I find, again, just another added layer, but I thought it was very interesting.
Yes. I think the Lance's point of part of the interrogation was fishing. If you look at Mark 14:55, it says the chief priests and the council sought testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. So they were looking for him to incriminate himself, and that's a good point about the disciples, that they were probably looking for him to incriminate the disciples as well.
I think to that point, there was criminal action. You know, when Malchus got his ear cut off, and I think that in the back of their mind, they knew that was someone who supported Jesus. Whether a disciple or not, they might not have known that. But, you know, I think that might have been a reason why they're entering that now, where they're like, hey, we let these people go. Someone cut off this guy's ear. Like, hey, what about your disciples? You know, and maybe trying to catch him that way, where, you know, they show a danger or a threat to their power. That's what it was all about.
Anybody else? It's...